Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hi, everyone. Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Glad you could join us for our podcast again this week. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. This is a first of a two-part conversation with Kim Cameron. Kim is a professor at the University of Michigan Ross School of Business. He is a thought leader in the area of positive leadership. He wrote a book by that title, and he's written over 15 books in his career. And he has some just great insights he's going to share with us and thoughts around how to become a more positive leader. And looking forward to our conversation with Kim.
It's great to have Kim Cameron joining us from Michigan this morning. And Kim, I guess first off, can you just give us a little bit of your background and your story?
Sure. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for the chance to be on your show. And thanks for the chance to talk to you. It's a delight to meet you. I started out learning about or beginning to learn about organizations in an undergraduate program at Brigham Young University in sociology, but I learned that there are way too many ization words in sociology: centralization, specialization, formalization, and so on. Never did make much sense to me. So I ended up getting a PhD in a multidisciplinary program at Yale. We had psychologists, sociologists, economists, political scientists, and this potpourri of faculty members, 20 students, 13 faculty. So my largest course was 5 students. It was a wonderful experience, way, way too expensive now for any program to run like that. But I ended up, my first job was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Then I ran a research center in Boulder, Colorado, studying how to manage colleges and universities. During that period of time, the major challenge faced by higher education was that the baby boomer had cohort had been through the higher education system. Their children had been through the higher education system, and there was a dramatic drop-off in simply the number of college-age students available to go to school. The prediction was, that was 400,000 fewer students. The prediction was, if you spread that across 3,500 colleges and universities in the United States, about a third of colleges are going to go out of business. Mm-hmm. So decline, retrenchment became a big issue. So we started studying, well, how do organizations manage retrenchment? The reason that's important is every theory, every model of organization performance assumes that bigger is better. We get more next year than we got this year, we're doing better. Our scores go up, we're doing better. Nobody had studied, well, what happens when you have to manage going south? Well, I finished that 3 years running that research center and then came to the University of Michigan, wanted to continue that. So I went to start studying businesses. And the word that was current at the time was downsizing, retrenchment, consolidation. There were lots of words, but downsizing was the key. Over a 10-year period of time, what we discovered is that almost all organizations that downsize deteriorate in performance. That is, profitability goes down, morale goes down, engagement goes down, communication goes down, and customer satisfaction goes down, and so on. However, that led, what I observed is 10 or 15% of organizations flourished after experiencing downsizing. So the question became, what's the difference between that small number that gets a lot better and everybody else that doesn't? I didn't have data, but the assumption that I was beginning to make as a result of observing and studying these schools is that the organizations that got better were characterized by virtuous practices: compassion, forgiveness, integrity, generosity, and so on. Now, the trouble is, certainly back then, that was not a legitimate way to describe any organization. The word virtuous, too philosophical, too religious. I mean, so I decided I was going to shift my focus and study the extent to which you could measure or identify what it means to be a virtuous organization. I mean, how would you know that that was the case? What would you look at? How would you measure it? And then if you could measure it, how would you improve it or change it or help an organization try to implement it? Well, I had just, long story short, I got together with two colleagues here at the University of Michigan, Jane Dutton, who had organized a compassion lab. That is, she began, well, there's a long story, about how she got interested in compassion, but she began the same assumptions that I had, and that is that compassion can be an organization phenomenon as well as an individual phenomenon. And then my friend Bob Quinn, with whom we've had a close association since we were 21 years old, been studying deep change and so on, we got together and created a center. The motivation for the center was we knew that it's the default option normally of professors is to go do their own work, sit in the library, sit in your office and get your work done. We didn't want to do that. We wanted to learn from each other. So a center was the glue that put us together. And the center is called the Center for Positive Organizations. And that center is now focused on multiple aspects of what it means to be a positive organization. Virtuousness, for sure. Positive deviance, extraordinarily spectacular, positive, positively speaking, positive performance. And then sort of an affirmative bias, regardless of the challenge, the difficulty, the problems, is there a way to focus on the positive aspects of that? And if you do that, what happens to organizations and to employees? So my own work now for the last maybe almost 20 years has been focused on how do you measure virtuousness, and especially how do you help organizations become more virtuous, and how does that translate into leadership? So we talk about the phrase positive leadership as being simply defined as focusing on a set of practices, all of which lead organizations to flourish, to thrive, to be better, to be positively deviant. Now that's a long mark, a long explanation of where I, of how I got to where I am.
It sounds like an interesting journey. And I know when I had a conversation a while back with Bob Quinn, he spoke highly of your partnership and your work together. And it's fun to hear about your journey. I ask this question of every person that comes on or most every guest that we have on, and I'm curious of your answer. But if knowing what you know now, if you were to think back when you were in your early 20s, 22-year-old Kim, what advice would you give him knowing what you know now?
You know, I have gotten some good advice along the way. One of the pieces of advice that I got was from a senior guru professor that I didn't have in class. He actually joined the university after I left, after I graduated. But I went back during a summer because I knew that he was there, and I asked him to take me on as an independent study student as I was preparing to try to figure out where I wanted to get my PhD. He handed me a couple of articles that he'd written. They were classic articles. I knew them. He was the person that sort of defined a certain area of sociology, actually, at the time. He said to me, here, I want you to read these papers, and I want you to give me advice about how I can improve these papers. I said to him, look, I know these papers. I know that they're the benchmark. I mean, I can't improve this work. These are classics. He said, well, you and I need to have a conversation then. He sat me down and he said, look, when you go get your PhD, if I treat you as a subordinate, you're always going to be a subordinate. It's not going to change. I don't want a subordinate. I want a colleague. So look, I know some things you don't, but you know some things I don't. I mean, we have different experiences. I want you to teach me as much as I teach you so that we have a collaborative relationship, so that we grow together. That It was a brand new idea for me. I mean, I was a student, he was a professor, and I thought, well, I'm subordinate. You feed me and I'll eat. I learned that contribution was a key element in almost every relationship and every learning activity. So since then, I've done a whole bunch of research, as it turns out, on contribution as a predictor of performance. That is, making contributions is actually a higher a factor that's more important in predicting positive outcomes for me and for others than is achievement or goal accomplishment. So there are two kinds of goals. I need to make that more clear. Two kinds of goals. This study was done at the University of Michigan, in which a group of freshmen were all identified as they entered Michigan. They were asked to identify their goals for the year. Now, everybody has lots of goals, but they were categorized into two types. Achievement goals: I want to get good grades, I want to be popular, I want a girlfriend, I want to get elected to a club office or something. The other kind of goal was called contribution goals. I want to make a difference. I want to have something to get better because I would have contributed. So people were put into two groups depending on which type of goal was dominant. Then the study was to simply follow these students for 1 year, measuring things like, for example, how well they got along with the roommates, social factors, you know, how many times they got elected to a club office and so on, what their grade point average was, what their test scores were at the end of each semester, cognitive, academic factors, how many minor physiological symptoms they experienced, got the flu, headache, nausea, cramps, and so on, they missed class. So physical factors. On every single dimension, those with contribution goals did better on every statistically significant difference on every dimension, cognitive, social, physiological, than those who had achievement goals. That is, contribution was a better predictor of performance than achievement. Well, I learned that early, and that would probably be my advice, is that be a contributor, make a difference. Don't worry about popularity. Don't worry about fame. Don't worry about making sure everybody knows your work. Forget that. Just make a contribution.
Great. Yeah, great advice. As we're living during some unusual times, and we were talking a little bit before we started our podcast this morning, that things look differently than they did last fall for you and for everybody else that's listening. During this time, and you know, I was telling you that, you know, the leaders that I'm talking to, a lot of them sound kind of exhausted over the last, you know, 4 or 5 months that we've been going through this pandemic. What is some advice that you give a leader that to stay positive? You've spent the last 20 years of looking at positive leadership and the difference it can make in organizations, but What are some things that you could give somebody some advice just to maybe help them in during this time?
It's a good question, and I wish there was a cookbook, Mark. If there were, we'd all be doing different things if we had that the ideal. But I'll tell you a little bit about what I've studied and what I've become convinced of. You and I mentioned just barely before we started. One of the key findings that has emerged out of my own work is something referred to as the heliotropic effect. Now, I need to define what that is. As it turns out, every living system, everything alive, has a tendency toward the light and away from dark, or toward positive energy, away from negative energy. See, in nature, the sun is a source of positive energy. It's the life-giving force. So every living system, literally from single-cell organisms to complex human systems, everything alive has a tendency to that which is life-giving, positive energy, and away from that which is life-depleting. That is, negative energy sucks the life out of people. Negative energy does that. Well, if that's true, and it is, there's lots of evidence that that's true, and I won't go into all that. But if that's true, that is, if positive energy is a life-giving force and negative energy is life-depleting, then in this environment in which we live, where there's lots of challenges, obstacles, uncertainty, chaos, life-depleting forces, then what we're advised to do, what we should be doing, is to try to counteract those with life-giving, life-enhancing, life-facilitating forces or positive energy. Now, what would be positive energy? Well, there are lots of kinds of positive energy. One kind is called physical energy, which when I use it, it diminishes. I mean, if I run a marathon, I can't do it again. I got to have recuperation time. So using physical energy diminishes over time. Mental energy is the same. When I use it, I get exhausted. I need recovery time. That's why we have semester breaks and so on. Right. Emotional energy is the same. I get in an intense interaction. I'm debating somebody. I get exhausted. Mental energy diminishes with time. The only kind of energy that elevates with use is called relational energy. Well, what's relational energy? Well, when I interact with Mark, what happens to my energy? Is he uplifting, elevating, life-giving, or is he exhausting, depleting, just sucks the life right out of me? In which case, he's a de-energizer. Well, as it turns out, there are lots of factors that foster, create positive relational energy. And we can measure that pretty easily in organizations. The research is very clear that positively energizing leaders get substantially higher results in their organization than normal leaders. So, for example, one of the ways to measure relational energy is to simply have people rate the relationship they have with other people. So when I interact with Mark, what happens to my energy? Am I uplifted, elevated? Is he life-giving or exhausting, depleting? In which case is a de-energizer. I can measure that just on a Likert scale. I give him a 1, I would give this relationship a 1 if it's very de-energizing, a 7 if it's very energizing. So in a team, or a senior level team, or we've done that with entire organizations with thousands of people, you can measure the relational energy among various people. You're not rating the person, you're rating a relationship. Okay. Another way, by the way, that's one way to measure who's the leader. Another way is on the basis of influence. I mean, 95% of the leadership literature equates leadership and influence. If you're influential, you can get people to do what you want them to do. That means you're a leader. That's normally the assumption. Sometimes there's another third, that's sometimes information, the smartest person, the person who's most informed, the person who has access to all the information, all the organization secrets, that's the leader. So you can measure, or you can create influence networks, information networks, or energy networks. Turns out, here's the results of the research, and here's the whole point. Your position in the energy network is 4 times more important in predicting performance than your position in the influence network or the information network. That is, energy trumps influence by a factor of 4. And the question is, well, does anybody ever manage energy? I mean, does anybody ever get hired or promoted or, you know, rewarded in any way for being a positive energizer? Normally not. We don't even know it exists. But it trumps what we normally manage by a factor of 4. That's one factor. Second, if Mark is a positive energizer and I can just get around him, my performance goes up. That is, positive energizers affect the performance of other people around them. There's lots and lots of examples of that. And then the third major finding is the highest performing organizations have at least 3 times more positive energizers than normal organizations. The whole point is everybody can be one. Everybody can be a positive energizer. Everybody can't be influential. I mean, if you're influential and I'm influential and we disagree, most likely we're going to fight or there's going to be conflict. On the other hand, if you're a positive energizer and I'm a positive energizer, rather than conflicting, I mean, there's no reason to fight about who's the most positively energizing. In fact, because it's heliotropic, I'm attracted to positive energy, you and I most likely are going to collaborate. So you can see why organizations that have a lot of positive energizing going on are much more collaborative, much higher performers. They simply do better. So that's one of the pieces of advice. Find the positive energy in the system. Find the positive energizers in the system and just capitalize on that. Find ways to put yourself in a position where there's positive relational energy. Sometimes that's family. Sometimes it's putting a team together. Sometimes it's simply having interactions. When we're isolated, it's tougher, but it's possible. You and I are having at least some kind of relational energy going on right now.
So during this time that we're, a lot of people are working virtually, and you know, the energy that comes through the screen is different than being there in person. Anything that would help a leader to be able to keep his team, the energy level up? Any thoughts around that of what's worked?
Thank you. So I'm going to rely on some of this research we're doing regarding practicing some virtuous activities. For example, the idea of gratitude. You've heard that before. It's become relatively popular. It all emerged as a result of a study by a friend of mine, Bob Emmons, who in his class had all the students keep a journal. Everybody was required every single day to write in his or her journal. However, half the class was required to keep a gratitude journal. Write down three things every day for which you're grateful, or write down the three best things that happened to you today. The other half just wrote down three events, three people he interacted with, three problems they faced. At the end of the semester, several studies were done. One is all the students were given a flu shot. 7 days later, those students had, they were tested for the number of antibodies in their system. Those keeping a gratitude journal were significantly healthier, had more antibodies in their system than those not keeping a gratitude journal. They did a study of, there's been more than just the students, but in addition to that, there was a study done with heart health patients, people who had heart difficulties. Half of these people were assigned to keep a gratitude journal for 8 weeks. Half didn't. At the end of 8 weeks, they tested heart health. Those keeping a gratitude journal had deteriorated less, and actually their hearts had healed more than those not keeping a journal. And so on. There are a whole bunch of those practices. So one of the things we do in our organization, including virtual meetings on Zoom, is that we start every meeting going around the group, asking everybody to take 30 seconds or so to simply say, what's the best thing that's happened to you this last week or this last month? Or what should we celebrate? We just inject a bit of positive energy. That's one thing. A second thing I would suggest is back to that notion of contribution. The idea that contribution trumps achievement, you know, has been verified. So what would that mean? Well, one of the ways to think about contribution instead of just rewarding people for doing well, one of the people in our business school knows about this. She's in charge of all the faculty support personnel, the secretaries, essentially. She's instituted a 1+1 award system. So if you do especially well, I give you an award, but then I give you a second one, which you can hand to somebody else. I don't know about them, but you do. So every time somebody excels, they get a chance to give an award. Delta Airlines does something similar to that. I mean, I've reached the 3 million mile mark on Delta. But what does Delta give me for being a loyal flyer? They give me certificates, which I can then hand to a Delta employee, a flight attendant, a gate agent, somebody. When they do something extraordinary or special, I hand them a certificate. Now, I'm not sure what that does. It's points in their bank. It's free flights or something. But when I do that, I mean, they get teary. I've had people want to give me hugs, you know, as a result of having me hand them a certificate. It is a big deal to them. I mean, I think Delta gets it right. My reward for being a good customer is I get a chance to give something to somebody else. That is so terrific for me. And so on. I mean, there are a whole bunch of find ways to contribute. Now, many times an organization that's will volunteer, will go help City Year or Habitat or something. Sometimes, however, it's just in our meetings. This week, Mark, you're assigned to teach us all something that you've learned that's new and interesting. Next week, my turn. And by the time we get around the group, about every 2 months, you've got to have learned something new that you're going to teach us. I mean, everybody is a contributor and takes that seriously. We're going to help the entire group get better. So that's just, I mean, those are small, incremental, easily implemented factors, the research of which shows that positive energy performance goes up.
Thanks for joining us for our podcast this week. Please join us next week as we continue our conversation with Kim Cameron. Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.